Welcome to an encore episode of Words and Pictures, spotlighting the surreal genius of Bruce Bickford. I'm S.W. Konser, and in 2008, Bill Dodge and I got a chance to sit down with celebrated Seattle clay animator Bruce Bickford. He was visiting Portland's Baghdad Theater, where his recently re-released film Prometheus's Garden was being honored. Bickford first gained fame in the 1970s when musician Frank Zappa commissioned him to create the animation for the film Baby Snakes. In 2004, an award-winning documentary about Bickford, titled Monster Road, was directed by Brett Ingram. On April 28, 2019, Bruce Bickford died at the age of 72, having maintained his independent streak for half a century and having influenced a generation of guerrilla filmmakers along the way. During this time of social distancing, when KBOO is unable to hold its traditional spring membership drive, we'd like to encourage you to support community radio by going to kboo.fm. And now, Bruce Bickford, in conversation with Bill Dodge and S.W. Konser, recorded August 18th, 2008.
Isn't it remarkable, this little planet we're on?
If Bill Gates wanted to, he could have, like, you know, 50 animation rooms. The only thing stopping Bill Gates from doing that is a complete lack of awareness of what he should be doing. I saw Peter Pan, you know, he had the power. How he was a little guy, I was a little guy. Like, maybe I had a chance. Like, maybe the little guys could survive. When something really grotesque or ugly occurs in one of my pieces of animation, I try to have it resolved somehow. I try to have the character who's behaving terribly get their comeuppance quite swiftly.
That's Bruce Bickford, stop motion clay animator.
Doing stop motion, it's hard to make things perfect. With the use of frame grabbers and whatnot, which I've never used, I've never had that technology, using that you probably could make something look virtually flawless. But part of the charm of stop motion is the fact that there are all these little bits of imprecision in the movement. Subliminally or subconsciously, that lets the viewer know that someone has been there, that someone made that happen every frame of the way. Whether it hits you this way consciously or not, what you're looking at is concentrated energy. Every nuance of the thing means someone had to make it that way. That's, I think, a large amount of why animation has its appeal, and stop motion animation, because it doesn't look real, and it probably shouldn't look real.
Bruce, could you please tell us how you ended up working with Frank Zappa?
Well, I was in L.A. in early 73 looking for work, just trying to find animation studios or houses. And eventually I got to Murakami Wolf, where they did some animation for 200 Motels from like a year or two before. And I showed them what I had, and they put me in touch with Cal Schenkel, who worked directly with them for the stuff for 200 Motels. And so Cal arranged for me to meet Frank at his house. And Cal is a guy who did a lot of, Cal did a lot of Frank's album covers. And the...
like the Grand Wazoo and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, just a number of them, Reuben and the Jets and Sofa, and did them for a number of years. And so...
did that work inspire you? When did you see that kind of work before you met up with Cal and Frank? Did you around record stores to know what that stuff was about, or listen to the music?
I didn't know that one guy did those covers, but I remembered the animation in 200 Motels, and I was thinking when I went to work for Frank that I'd be working more with Cal, because before I was actually signed on, Cal showed me a storyboard he had for a pup tentacle. Oh, it was a parody song Frank had about this famous organist from the 50s who was a black guy who American Negro guy who pretended to be East Indian. He wore a turban, Corla Pandit, yeah. In the song it was Corla Plankton. And Frank was on to the guy, I guess, and was doing just a spoof on that guy. And Cal had a whole storyboard for this thing and was wondering if I could animate parts of it. And I said, sure. I mean, it looked easy, but it didn't happen. I mean, a lot of things during that Zappa period. You take two people who have messed up attention spans like me and Frank, and I mean, it just combination of the two, it's even less. There's even less cooperation.
Late at night is when they come out.
Baby snakes.
Sure you know what I'm talking about. Make it win. They make the best kind of head.
Baby
snakes. I look around and there's a couple right near me.
Baby snakes.
Maybe I think they can probably hear me. Make it win. I'll take all I can get. Baby.
Baby
snakes. They live in a ho ho, a ho ho ho. That is usually empty.
Tiny
too. They live by a ho ho, a ho 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 ho. That is usually senti, which stands for
Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers.
So probably the most famous work that you collaborated with Frank Zappa was Baby Snakes back in 1979 that was released. Tell us a little bit about that project.
Well, there would have been much more animation in there, except that in 76, Frank fired his manager, Herb Cohen, and he forgot to get talk about attention span. Frank forgot to get all my early animation back from Herb first. So Herb was sitting on that stuff clear up into the 90s. I don't know how many years he had it. And so that stuff didn't go into Baby Snakes. It had to wait. Frank eventually put it into The Amazing Mr. Bickford. But by then, by 1980, I had signed that stuff off. I had lost all ownership of it because I hadn't seen that early stuff. I turned over most of my early animation to Frank in 74 when I went to work for him. And that's the stuff Herb ended up sitting on for years and years. And by the time I parted with Frank, I hadn't seen that early stuff in so long that I'd forgotten how much work I put into it. I didn't know how to value it anymore. And so I let it go. And, the Zappa people own that stuff now. And
I hope they re-release it on DVD.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a cautionary tale to all artists, really.
But the stuff that did go into Baby Snakes, like the Gregory Peccary stuff, that was stuff that was, he wanted certain things, certain Gregory Peccary images animated, and I did that, but he was dissatisfied with it and wanted me to do it over, and he was going to get me a storyboard to work with, a timing sheet. So I guess I could get it even closer hooked up to the music, but he forgot about getting me the timing sheet, so I just went on animating something else, and Frank pretty much gave up on trying to get me to do particular things. He just wanted me to keep animating, and I failed in a lot of ways. I spent a lot of time making clay figures that never got used, and sometimes he would have ideas for things that he would forget about. And so, you know, between the two of us, we messed things up a lot of times.
So Gregory Peccary is this little character that's sort of an ambitious businessman. He's got Trendmongers and associates going. They're always trying to come up with a new idea to make cash. So it's too bad that didn't all gel, because there's a lot of crazy stuff going on there. Just the parody of American business and silly trends like air hockey and things that become a fad for a short while.
Well, yeah, Frank was rather ambitious about that Gregory Peccary thing, and Big Swifty, the guy who ran the Trendmongers and all
right.
that. And one day when I went into his basement to meet with him, he says, "Now, this Gregory Peccary stuff has potential." He says, "There's a TV station in Sweden that's interested in a Gregory Peccary television show."
Wow.
But that was the last time I ever heard of that.
I was in the hospital in 96 with pneumonia. I was in bed and there wasn't much to do. So I just kind of laid back and tried to sleep, but I couldn't sleep because they drugged me up on something, and it was that glucose plus the antibiotics, and it was making me hallucinate. And I'd even see things in the room with my eyes open in the dim light, any object that had a little kind of a vague little head shape, I'd see little faces on it, turning around, twitching and winking, and in general just trying to make me feel nervous. And the stuff they were pumping into me was not doing me, it was harming the hell out of me, that's what it was doing. But the only thing I liked about it was this little noise it would make. Every 20 seconds maybe it would go beep, it would make this little noise, and to me it was like there was an ocean or something, and there was, and that was a little lighthouse, and that was a foghorn. And something came to me suddenly. It was the luck of a foghorn. Later, like a year or two later, I figured out what that meant, what the luck of a foghorn was. It was that when this guy gets on the magic swing, if you get swinging fast enough and go clear around on the swing, not just back and forth, each time you go around, you can see across the ocean, you can see it into a different age. When he finally just sprang off of that thing and went into a void, he was just levitating out there. He heard the foghorn, and that reminded him where he was. And he came down to the beach, and the foghorn was up the beach there. So it truly was luck of a foghorn. Without that, he might not have made it.
Looking at Prometheus's Garden, the feature of yours that's been re-released, I just see all these mythical and historical and forces of nature themes going on in there. When you mentioned Ray Harryhausen, who did all these Greek mythology movies such as Jason and the Argonauts and Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, yeah, that seems to be definitely an influence on you. Your work just is always reflecting historical, mythical. How would you describe the themes of Prometheus's Garden?
Oh, well, if I use those things from mythology, those kind of images, it's partly probably just maybe relying on things that are images people know about or understand, because I'm not a very literary person. I don't read much. Because I can't read very fast. I never have been a fast reader. In school, I was always poor at that. Yeah, I was also really bad at math. But I can read, but I'm slow, and I don't have much attention span at reading a whole book, because it's like numbers, letters are kind of boring to me. There's not enough variation in them. I'm more picture oriented. I'm image oriented, and things like mythological creatures or whatever, I don't know. I guess I kind of strive for things that most people would understand.
Like things in the collective mind, maybe, things that occur in dreams, images that you might see in a dream.
I tend not to analyze my own stuff that much. I'm more intent on just doing it. I've got so many stories in the works. I've got this story file with just these three long boxes of hanging files, and there's about, I don't know, 180 stories there. But most of them are still really in rough form. They're but there's probably at least 10 of them that are written out well enough that you could read them. And they're all just hugely detailed. And that's another reason why I don't read much, because I don't have time to read. I have all this writing to do, and every time I get an idea for it, I try to write it down as soon as I can before I forget it, and these things just pile up on my desk, and occasionally I'll sort them out and slip all the pages into the right folders or cut them up and separate the ideas and get them with the story they fit with. And now and then I'll pull one of those files out of the box and start working on it. Put things in the right sequence and fill in the gaps and try to flesh that story out. But it's not a totally disciplined process. It's rather slapdash. The most discipline is just in trying to eventually get things in the right order that the story makes real sense.
So the editing part is most important, because it sounds like the process, and I know other filmmakers and writers do this too, they know that they've got a lot of good material, but they're not always concerned about where it ends exactly. Once they've got enough material, then they know how to end it or bring it together and make it the way they were maybe not planning to do it originally. Is that's kind of what you're getting at, where you want to leave at least a little element of chance in this?
Oh, well, with a good story, I want to make it as perfect as possible, so there's no loose ends left dangling.
But during the process. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I know in films, editing is often very important, because they keep shooting a scene till they think they've got it right, and then it's the editor's job to go through all that film and make sure they're using the right take or whatever. But that's a level way beyond what I'm working at. I seldom do any retakes. And the stuff I've got so far is really pretty rough. If you examine it, there's a lot of things. If I was working for a studio, they would never pass. They would say, do that over.
So I guess what I was getting at is your process of writing and process of animating about the same in terms of where you end up with what
well,
you're
the
done?
Animating, since I'm not working for a studio, I'm just doing it to satisfy myself. Even if I start out with a storyboard, it usually doesn't last. I mean, I get diverted from what I was originally thinking about. I mean, because things come up in the animation, we're doing transformations, certain shapes come out of the process. Like if a clay thing is bursting open, the way the clay rips apart, just naturally, the texture of the clay, you might see stuff in that lumpy, torn apart texture that looks like something or gives a suggestion of something. And so then I might start, it's something I can't pass up. It's too tantalizing. I have to start putting some eyeballs or something in there and gradually taking that rough shape and try to gently transform it into a new image, and then just keep going with that.
So the landscapes and the characters tell you what they want to do, tell you what they want to become.
That happens quite often.
Hey,
I go for the lowest common denominator. Just get some stuff in front of the camera and get some action out of it. Get the most I can out of those figures before they wear out.
When they're kids, they can kind of see the direction they're going.
I think I made these about a year ago, so they're ready to pick up a sword and have at it.
Some of the descriptions on this DVD release of Prometheus's Garden, wildly imaginative and morbidly funny, and psychedelic metamorphosis, surreal, absurd, and metaphorical. You think they did a pretty good job describing it in a few words, what you're up to?
Sure.
And I was really enjoying this featurette on the DVD called Luck of a Foghorn. And can you comment a little bit about the music that was chosen for that? Brett Ingram got Laird Dixon to do the music for it.
You know, I've only seen that about twice so far. But I thought the music worked pretty good. And I've never met the musician and know nothing about him, really. He's just someone that Brett found.
Yeah, I couldn't help noticing that parallel between Dixon's music and Zappa's music. Obviously, he's not copying Zappa note for note, but there's still that kind of feeling, that general feeling that I got from seeing Baby Snakes the first time, marveling at that match of music and animation is something. When that clicks real well, it's to me, that's some of the most entertaining film I can see.
Isn't it remarkable? This little planet we're on, is this the headquarters for something?
That's
Bruce Bickford,
stop motion clay animator.
You've been listening to a very special encore episode of Words and Pictures, honoring celebrated stop motion animator Bruce Bickford. I'm S.W. Counser, and this show was recorded in 2008 and edited by my co-host, Bill Dodge. Before we go, I'd like to remind you that your community radio needs your support during this time of social distancing. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm.